Welcome to Elaine's Literary Salon. I'm Jeffrey Higgins. This is my wife Cynthia's in my restaurant. We've turned it into a home for authors. You are number 214 or 215 since we started. We have a podcast, Elaine's Literary Salon. You can find us on elainesliterarysalon.com. We're number one on Apple and Spotify. I'm excited about this one today. So Dr. C. Victor Urban III, PhD, is an executive leadership strategist, organizational culture researcher, combat veteran, and author focused on helping leaders identify the hidden behaviors that quietly shape workplace culture over time. His work centers on organizational arrogance, a leadership and cultural phenomenon that explores how overconfidence, dismissiveness, and disparagement can gradually become normalized within organizations and evolve into cultural patterns that damage trust, accountability, psychological safety, and long-term performance. Dr. Vick's background spans more than 20 years of leadership experience across military, federal, and private sector environments. He served as a U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel with 3 combat deployments in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom and was awarded the Bronze Star Medal for leadership and service. His assignments included Battalion Command, the Pentagon, and the White House Communications Agency. Following military service, he continued supporting senior federal consulting engagements with DHS, TSA, NGA, CISA, and NASA. He holds a PhD in organizational leadership from Regent University and is an ICF Associate Certified Coach. He's here to discuss his book, Organizational Arrogance, How Superiority Behaviors Become Cultural Arrogance, and What Every Leader Must Do to Stop It. So please welcome Dr. Urban. Thank you. I got to admit, I interview hundreds of authors in here, but I was really excited to talk to you about this because it's super important, and you are absolutely the guy to talk about this stuff. So welcome, first of all.
All right. Good to be here. Good to be here.
By the way, we are recording this for our podcast, so we'll have this up later. And so we're going to do about 45 minutes, and we'll come around, and we'll do some Q&A, and then you're going to do a session after that, right? Going around taking answers and things, so get people plenty of time to go through the details of what we're talking about here. So why don't you start? Just give us a little bit of what's a book about. Give us a little synopsis.
Well, a synopsis really is identifying and placing a name on something we have seen and witnessed for years in the workplace, and we just accepted it. And you have this feeling of dismissiveness, and where you may be able to provide some input, some guidance, some advice to a senior leader, to a peer, and it seems that's overlooked. And then there's this piece where you may have some insight or guidance, and someone says, well, I already know that. So this level of overconfidence, it's like, okay, I can't tell this person anything. Almost 99% of everything they know the answer to. Is there a 0.1% that they may not know? And every time you submit something, I know that, or we're gonna do it this way. And then the worst part was the seeing opportunities where people are maltreatment, ridiculed, belittled. And so being able to witness some of that within my leadership journey, I said, okay, what is going on here? And that really prompted the question, why is this happening? What makes it happen? And how can we stop it? And that led to the creation of Organizational Arrogance for my dissertation.
That is such a rich environment. And I see people as you're talking kind of nodding because everybody's experienced that. Well, so let me just, before we get into it, like this, how did this differ from your expectations on writing a book? Because a lot of people, you know, subject matter experts, and I've interviewed them across all these different disciplines. There's one thing to know something, and you do writing as a PhD, right? But now you're writing a book for a fairly broad audience. How did that change from your expectations to actual execution?
It's a challenge. One, you're taking something from the academic realm, where the scholarly writing is a particular style of writing, based off your literature review and your deep research and all these multi-syllable words. And then saying, okay, this sounds great. This presents well. You argue the defense. And then say, okay, now this is great. This is presented for the body of knowledge. Well, that's the disconnect. It's presented for the body of knowledge. And I associate academia almost like a zoo, where you will find these phenomenons and you placed it behind this journal article. And all these other academics read between this journal article and these practitioners. Wow, this is an interesting phenomenon. Similar when you go to a zoo and say, wow, the white saber tiger. And it stays behind this glass. And people go and they read through it and they say, wow, that's pretty interesting. They go back home. So it's stuck there. There's research that I started in 2014 we're still talking about in 2026. So when can we take it from the world of academia and the practitioners, the consultants who are knowing and executing this, yet the person who is still in that cubicle experiencing this says, well, help me. If you're studying me and you're seeing what's happening in my work environment in the wild, where when is someone going to come save me? And so being able to identify that disconnect as I was working in consulting, saying, okay, why are we still having this challenge? And so now the task was, how do I take this very rich dissertation, translate into, for the public, the person at Starbucks to be able to read and say, this happens to me too. And so that was a big challenge because now how do I make this appeasing, but also how do I take away the lexicon where anyone could say, okay, I understand what this is occurring. So really a very deep process, very challenging process, but it took about 10 years to do that.
Wow. Congratulations, by the way. Big project. I mean, people don't realize what a big project these things are. Even when you have a dissertation, something that you're working from is so incredibly hard. What you said there is really interesting, though. Why is it that academic papers have to use a certain language? Because, you know, academics are people, you know, and they're still trying to communicate ideas, which is at the heart of it. Do you think, is this something that just institutionally has been passed down? Is it a cultural thing within academia where they feel like something has to be written at a certain level? Because I get this a lot with some other, you know, other people are writing for a more general audience. Like you can, for my postgraduate work, like you just read so much stuff. It's almost incomprehensible sometimes. Like, is that almost like a badge of courage for academics that they have to write like that? Like, why is that? Did you have any insight into that?
I wish I had the insight. I just know I continue to drink the water. But it is one of those things where you write it, you read it. That doesn't sound smart enough. That doesn't sound academic enough. And then you rewrite it again. I need two more syllables. This two-syllable word doesn't work. Let me add four syllables. And then feeling as if that will generate that more scholarly, but it shows that large vocabulary, well-researched, identifying concepts, and then being able to package. But again, it goes back to the analogy I use of the zoo. So who is our audience? If our audience is other academics that want to operate in this space of high knowledge, great. But if my research is really dedicated not only to the body of knowledge, but also to help society and the work environment, now I got to speak to them. And so it is almost that the rite of passage from the academic world and how to esteem yourself as a doctor, but not allowing that to take you away from, at the end of the day, I'm still here to serve. And that's a title of service.
So why doesn't that happen more when you're talking about like leadership? Because if you're looking in academia more like esoteric types of topics, I can understand why there's this disconnect and maybe the way it's applied in real life is different. But you're talking about leadership, right? You're something that's every company. There's a profit motive behind it. There's governmental agencies. Why is that not done more? Why is that academia disconnect still existing?
I would say that many times the disconnect comes where it goes back to the audience. Who are we talking to? If we have CEOs, we have managers that have expressed this challenge, you're hiring high-paid consultants, and we're taking a thought, but we're not using the research-backed thoughts to say, okay, now what is the end state? What is the problem? One of the things you learn as you work for, whether it's a master's program or your PhD, we identify a problem and then identify techniques and solutions to solve the problem, not solve the symptoms. And many times there's that disconnect where we're not looking at the root problem. And that's what organization arrogance does. It says, okay, yes, we can identify the symptoms, toxic leadership, destructive leadership, maltreatment, organizational silence. But now let's get to the point. Now we know it's there. We've seen it. Now what's creating that? And let's get to the root. I think many times that part is disconnected.
Do you think there's something, like, is there a psychological reason that's behind this? Because I'm thinking, like, you're talking about, you know, the facts, identify a problem, back it up with data, but then it's not brought into the whatever the practice is to solve the problem. And, like, I've seen that personally a lot in government where people, you'll have data, they just do things the way it's always been done. You know, is there some reason, some psychological reason you think why people can't apply data when maybe it creates some kind of cognitive dissonance because it doesn't match the, you know, what they've been told they're supposed to do?
I think, again, it goes back to being able to, one, be real with self and understand, okay, this data is here. Do we need to refute the data? We have the research, it shows this, and I agree with the cognitive dissonance. Okay, now I have a responsibility to accept the data. And once I have a responsibility to accept the data, now I have a responsibility to do something about the data. Otherwise, it gets back to what I always share, behaviors that become accepted become expected and reinforced. Same thing, whether it's between the academic world or what business say, well, what we're doing is still working. We're still making high profit margins. There's one thing, we're talking about organizations that are in the tank, people are disgruntled. There's another when we have organizations that are exceeding expectations, but yet people are still disgruntled. Okay, you know what? Well, we're still doing great. What is, so we had this toxic leadership. Oh, that may be a bad seed, but look at how he's producing. Look at how she's producing. Their section's still performing. At what extent? And what's the cost to the employees? And what's the cost to the organization?
So you say something really interesting in there. It's all very interesting. But there's one thing in particular that stuck out where you have this, like, as a leader, you have this requirement or this responsibility to then act on the data. Is that taught anywhere in leadership where people are supposed to be responsive, like an academic, to the leadership, right? You know, looking for confounding variables, looking, trying to say, okay, this actually does prove this thing within a reasonable margin. I don't know that that happens in leadership, you know, because I can tell you just personal experience. I briefed an agency head and showed him what he was doing was not effective and gave him the actual data. And he said, well, that's really aspirational that we change, you know, like, and so is that taught as part of leadership in your experience?
One of my philosophies were data plus the dialogue equals the desired results. Now, I can present the data, whether I'm the staff officer in the Pentagon or the White House or even working as battalion commander. This is the data. I have teammates that may say, hey, sir, hey, doc, this is the challenge we're running to. Give me the data. We're looking at the data. Now let's have the dialogue. If I can, you know, now from that dialogue, there should be which means an assumption, should be an expected result based off this data shows this. I presented the information. It's always a challenge. It's always interesting when it's, this walks the dog. Why would we go opposite? And it goes back to organization arrogance. If I had the data plus the dialogue to get the desired result, which supports this data, all five-page, white-page paper, and the individual still says, we don't want to do that. Okay, now we get to that point of overconfidence or dismissiveness. Okay, what part of this disconnects? So that always, from a workplace psychology or even human psychology within the workplace, that is the piece that leads to the organization arrogance. Like, okay, we're having this data. How can we refute that? If you're talking to an agency head and they say that's aspirational, so that's a level of dismissiveness. Why is it aspirational? I shared this is the direction we should go based off of this data. Do we agree this data is correct? Yes, I agree. Do we agree that this dialogue we're having supports this data? Yes. So the desired result should be here. Nah, it's aspirational. Wow. Okay, thank you for your time. I'm out of here. Because now I'm not going to get anywhere with this other than wasting both our times. And so that's the challenge where, whether I'm consulting, whether you're coaching, is being able to present the best data. But then if you're on the side of the decision maker and the data is coming to you, being still confident, but being able to accept the information so you can make the best decision. And I think that's the disconnect with many leaders, not making the best decision based off the data that's provided. And that will help build that cohesion of organizations and employees feeling valued. And that therein lies the problem.
So because you're doing this, you're a consultant and you're trying to show people the data, tell them they're doing something wrong. I mean, I'm sure like the charisma of the messenger has a lot to do with it, right? But also like we can all think in politics, you know, or economics, you'll see people that are talking about a theory and it doesn't work, right? And you can show the data that it doesn't work, yet people still, you know, are proponents of it. So there must be other motivations, whether it's ideological or things. Do you come into this like in like a business environment when you're looking to change something based on data? You've got the facts. What I'm telling you is right, right? But do you find like there are these other, either like political or ideological, like or whatever, right? Other motivations that are putting pressure on the person not to follow the data?
Many times that's why the first question I say is, what do you want out of this opportunity? No different when I'm coaching a client, a one-on-one client, or coaching for an organization. What is your expectation from this dialogue? I'm not in the position to just make money or any of those kind of things. I don't need that. I'm here to make an impact, and I want to make sure my team, when we come on site, is here to make the impact. So the first thing is, what's the motivation you hired me here? Oh, well, someone's breathing down our neck. Okay, so you're not really here because you're committed. You're here out of compliance. And that already tells the difference of someone's motivation. So whether it's a senior exec or a middle manager, what is your goal here? So now I know that they're open for change. They're open for at least understanding another perspective, a way, not the way. And so being able to have that conversation, now I can show the data. Data plus the dialogue equals desired results. I may not always get the desired results. However, organizations, it'll cost organizations a lot if they ignore what's happening. What does it cost? It costs a high turnover rate. It caused absenteeism. It'll cause people saying, you know what, I've had enough. And now you've ignored an opportunity, that blind spot, when Dr. Vick and his team at LTUI stops in and says, hey, listen, we have a solution, a possible solution to really fix this challenge. And they have a choice, accept or reject. And that reject will come down to some type of organizational cost or human cost.
So everything you're saying is so logical, right? So I want to take just a step back, if you don't mind, and talk about your background a little bit. So how long were you in the military?
20 years, 6 months, and 13 days.
Could you be more precise? Thank you for your service.
Two more seconds, yeah.
So how do you think the military does in teaching leadership?
Oh, I think it's great. What a great foundational, anywhere I speak, I say, my leadership journey, I want to make sure we always respect everyone's leadership journey. But my leadership journey was cultivated by the United States Army. And what a phenomenal experience at the age of 21, being responsible for over $10 million worth of equipment and 60 people, 60 men and women, 60 people who are someone's son or daughter or husband or wife, and being put in that opportunity, but also being able to learn alongside senior leaders that are mentoring me at that 21 years old, giving me permission to fail, but then learning. So it's a learning organization. And then the curriculum throughout, before we're promoted to a next level, there's a series of, we call PME, professional military education, that we had to go through, these almost like the crucibles. And so in that accountability system along the way, where this is the expectation, we go into any organization, we'll have a counseling, there's expectations, we're held accountable to that. And so that institution allowed so much checks and balances, where if you're identified as that weak link or that toxic leader, you will be sniffed out. And sometimes they're masked for a certain time, but eventually that will rise to the top and they will be dealt with accordingly. And that was a great opportunity to serve in.
I mean, I've never experienced anything like that in another organization. Do civilian organizations teach leadership in a similar way or at that level? Like, a lot of times you'll see, even like you mentioned earlier, successful companies are just riding the success. Like, how often do they make like teaching leadership a core part of the mission?
Not as often as I'd like. And that is probably my biggest challenge leaving from the military and transitioning to civilian life. And many of my military brothers and sisters will share those conversations. How's it going for you? I wish I could put a uniform on. Or what are they doing? You know, and that process and the frustration. Well, they're about the bottom line. But we can still get the bottom line if we work together as a team. So we're very centered on team building. And transition to the civilian, seeing so many organizations focused on the individual or my success, what I did, I'll step on their toes or their head to get to this next spot. And that is so foreign to us in the military. And so what I am trying to teach leadership or instruct in different ways, I'm more team centered. I'm a relations oriented leader. I believe we can grow and succeed as a team, a synergy, as opposed to just me. And so that has always been a challenge. So some of the great organizations I've seen in the civilian world have embedded leadership programs where they're aspiring leader programs, emerging leader programs. My company is able to implement some of those programs and help as they want to build some leadership things. The others that don't, it's just an OJT. And that's scary when I say, oh, how did they get here? Oh, they just know how to do this particular widget very well. So now they're receiving positions of authority and leadership based off of their technical competence, not their interpersonal skills. And now they've reached to the highest levels and they don't have great people skills. And now they're leading organizations based off of, well, I'm very smart. Yeah, but I don't need you to be very smart. I need you to be able to delegate and power and make sure your 15 people are very smart. And so that seems to have been the hardest challenge of adjusting from the military world to here. But being that learning the ways as a consultant and learning through academia, okay, I have to transition my military thought and go, okay, now as a researcher, okay, this is this environment. Now, how do I understand? How can I provide insight from either research base or experience, but meet them where they are? Hey, you can't be a military organization. So understand, what do you want out of your organization so I can help tailor, whether it's our training, workshops, or leadership development accordingly to make sure I meet that need.
I mean, so, you know, whether it's a civilian or military, there's a mission. And if everyone accomplishes it, like in a civilian business, everybody reaps a reward. So do you think it's the problem, the disconnect there is like this, maybe the self-selection that happens with like a volunteer military, where it's getting a certain type of person who's driven for that mission, whereas maybe in the civilian world, people are looking for the paycheck, or they're looking to do something more individually as opposed to the mission of the business. And the business is really just a vehicle for them to get to that personal goal.
I like that. Definitely. Well, what we find in the military, we're not the highest paid, but there's a collective goal, objective. There's a mission. Even if we want big scale, okay, I'm going to defend the national, the Constitution of the United States. Does a 17-year-old come out of college think about defending the Constitution of the United States? Maybe not. But it may be, I'm going to take care of my mom and dad. Maybe it's, oh, wow, I joined this organization. I want to take care of my teammates. And then as you climb the ranks as a senior, it's like, wow, I understand how big this mission is. And I am really 1% of the American population that has signed this oath. I am here to protect this country. So now that motivation changes. But the way that we're groomed in all the services is understanding it's a selfless service. Yes, we volunteered, but why am I here? And then we look at the person to our left and right and realize that's my person. I have to do everything I can to make sure they get home safely to say goodnight to their families. And they're going to do the same for me. And so now it becomes this very interdependent, very familial. And so when we do exit, you're right. There's this grooming piece, having some friends that have spent a whole life being civilian. Like, wow, you don't have this part. Oh, I just get up and I leave. How can you leave? You know, I don't know these people. I'm leaving. I'm putting my 2 weeks in tomorrow. Wow. And our loyalty from a military standpoint may keep us in the organization longer because we're like, hey, I'm committed to the mission. Even as we transition out, you don't need to stay there that long. No, I'm committed, but they're not doing anything for you. No, but I'm committed. And civilian peers say, they will drop you as soon as they can. You're so committed to something that you're a number and you're creating a bottom line for them. And that bottom line may one day become too expensive and you're gone. And so being able to adjust to that, understand how in the civilian sector, it can be more individualistic. So, okay, I got to make sure I take care of me. And so that is that difference that I witnessed. And so even as I go and consult, I always want to make sure it's, hey, leadership is universal. There's no civilian leadership, military leadership. It's leadership is universal. Now, how do we practice? How do we demonstrate effective leadership that regardless you have a suit tie on and a camouflage uniform, that you're going to get the best out of that leader and that leader is going to get the best out of that teammate?
You had such varied experience, right? From Iraq to Pentagon, the White House. As you promoted, as you rose in rank, did the style of leadership change or did the dynamics of that leadership change?
Oh yeah. Personally, the first 13 years of my career was at that tactical level. I'm deploying companies, I was a company commander in Iraq, I was a battalion operations officer in Iraq, and I was a brigade personnel officer in Iraq. So those first 13 years, and I joined the Army in 98, 3 years later, we're already 9-1 occurs. So my motivation, talked about motivation before, my motivation originally joining the Army is to go to law school. Wanted to go to law school, have a payment with law school, get out, be a sports attorney, stay in California. But 9-1 happens, my whole motivation changes. And so as we're going through that experience, it's okay, this is why I'm here. This is what I want to do. And so as I go through the process of evolving and growing, recognizing how I fit in along the way. And so when I get to the Pentagon, that was probably the first cultural experience that's outside this tactical level. One, I'm serving alongside many civilians. And because I was groomed Army and military, the tactical level, there may have been one or two civilians in my organization, but all the civilians on the installation supported us. So here I get to the Pentagon, 50,000 people, not soldiers, and they're of all types. And the military is the minority. So now I'm walking into this hallway and I'm like, what is going on here? What a culture shock. And all these civilians, they're older than me. And I'm like, what is going on? And so one day I see my general and I say, sir, how do you work in this environment? I'm just a year and a half out of my third tour to Iraq. And he says, what do you mean, Vic? I said, how do you work in this environment with all these civilians? You know, they don't understand this stuff. He said, stop it right there. I don't care if they have a suit and tie on or camouflage uniform. Everyone's entitled to good leadership. I said, but how do you do it? They don't talk like us. She said, yeah, we don't talk like them. But again, how this is now your big test. And I'm glad I got that professional butt chewing, because that experience led me to the White House. Those same civilians I was kicking and screaming that I didn't want to work for, I'm working for SES as political appointees, are the same ones that nominated me to work at the White House. And so I learned then the difference between positional authority, relational authority, that I may have the rank, but what does that mean? And then now learning the arts of diplomacy, learn the arts of sitting down and having conversations, that the difference between power and influence. There are some leaders that didn't have any rank, but they may have had time. I talk about the Miss Mary experience. She worked in the general's, the three stars office. And I'd bypass her all the time to try to get some documents signed. And she'd look at me and laugh when I'd always come back with my tail between my legs because I couldn't get this document signed. And then one day someone said, did you talk to Miss Mary? I said, no, who, the civilian? They said, yeah, you need to talk to Miss Mary. Talk to Miss Mary. She walks in that same office. I couldn't get in, gets it signed, and said, here you go. She says, what did you learn? I said, that you got a lot of power and influence. She said, no, I know that person's there, a lieutenant. Everyone in this building may not have the rank. They may not have the time, but we have experience and we know things. And so that allowed me to understand appreciation for everyone, everyone on the team, everyone in the organization has something to contribute. And so that helped shape my leadership to understand, okay, at these higher levels, it's about relationship building. I call it shipbuilding. Friendships, relationships, partnerships. That's no longer what I know, but who knows, who else knows, and how they can help build an effective team along the way. So that helped. That transition right there at Pentagon was the impetus of, hey, you cannot lead the same way you did with the soldiers when you're down in Iraq. This is a whole nother level, this enterprise level, and they kept on increasing from there.
You know, I worked in the federal government for over 20 years, so it was sort of the worst of both worlds in some ways, right? Because it's civilian, but it's also government, right? Right. So but one of the things I learned was the power of the lower order participants, right? And how much that person that you're talking about, who's a gatekeeper or whatever, can hold, and understanding that if you want to get anything done, you can sort of do it outside the system, you know, in trials, like it's the courtroom, this unofficial court group, right? So it's people who know each other and the relationships they have. How much of that have you brought, like, when going back now into, like, consulting for the civilian world?
Oh, that's top of the line. I hosted a course a couple weeks ago, talking about leadership is what it is, and talking about power and influence, and why have we identified what does power look like? What does authority look like? And everyone has this, oh, yeah, they look like this. They walk into a room like this. Okay, but what about the person that silently walks in the room, but has all the power and influence, but no one, they walk over that. And so being able to use those examples from the White House and the Pentagon and bring that to the civilian sector when I'm teaching, it starts to resonate more, because we have this ideal of what authority looks like, what leadership looks like. But it's also about how do you build these relationships? How are you become even more socially aware of those in your environment so that you can leverage that? And so that knowing that everyone has a voice. And that piece comes from my experience in Iraq, where everyone has a voice at the table. Being able to leverage that person that's in the motor pool, that junior enlisted, has an insight that I don't have. He may understand why that wrench is the most important wrench to fix this particular vehicle. And me not asking that one question or saying, okay, I hear everybody else around the table. You turn the wrench every day. What is your biggest challenge? Well, sir, this is the issue. Great. How much am I missing out not being able to have that conversation? They feel entrusted enough that I will listen and then execute off of that. And so those are what I try to bring, those types of stories on. Everyone on the team has a purpose. You hired men individuals on your team for a reason. You want them to do their job. So when they do it, help appreciate and value the input they provide. And so that is something I try to make sure I connect.
You have two great points in there. And one of them, I think it was Malcolm Gladwell who wrote about Korea Air, how it was crashing all the time or at a higher percentage. And they realized it was a cultural thing where the people in the cockpit couldn't contradict what the chief captain was saying, right? So it sounds like that's sort of what you're talking about, right? Like the person who has the information but culturally isn't allowed to speak up. Or do you still get that in civilian companies now that you're working with or that you consult with?
Oh, yeah. That's stage five cultural entrenchment. And that's the heart of organizational arrogance. That right there, where people have the insight, they have the guidance, and now they just stop talking. And that's almost a sign of something's off when organizational silence. Okay, everyone's just doing the head nod north and south around the staff meeting. not because they totally agree. It's like, let's just get up out of here. Because it doesn't matter what I say. We brought up this issue, this challenge, and it's always being dismissed, or we're being ridiculed, we bring it, or we look like we have the third eye in the middle of our head. No problem. We'll just sit here. And then what happens? Maybe the organization fails. Maybe a bad report comes through. And so that is the biggest challenge of organizational arrogance, is that piece right there, where there are individuals who believe that they have the end all be all knowledge, and negating the input of their teammates that says, okay, I know we've done it this way for so long, but there may be another way, and this may prevent this from happening. And that's the choice of that leader to say, okay, let's try it this way. Explain to me a little more, so that there is some collaborative part. So that is the biggest challenge. And that's what starts with oversharing.
Is the resistance behind that from the leadership side, like in maybe an insecurity that's manifesting in this, if I give this person a voice, or I change what I'm doing, or something I'm saying is not working, then I'm actually undermining my own authority? Is that where it's coming from? So it seems odd, right?
Yeah. Insecurity is one. When I found that we talk about the individual nature in some of the civilian corporate America. Wow, if I give up this idea and this person appears smarter than me, now maybe they'll take my job. Okay, no. How about that person enhances you, because now they show the power of delegation and empowerment, and you get promoted because now people will see this. And so that is the level of insecurity. There's the level of lack of self-awareness where, okay, who am I? My leader identity has been tied to this title, this rank. Okay, so I would rather be wrong. I'd rather be right to be wrong than to be right by listening to someone else help me not be wrong. And that's that piece, what drives that. So insecurity, it could be, like I said, the level of arrogance of saying, okay, I know more. I've been here longest. My titles speak, my years of service speak more than your intellect. You've been here for 3 years. I've been here for 6. Whatever that could be, but the baseline is insecurity at some level that maybe my decisions and maybe my ideals are not as thought out as I want them to be. And so yet I protect that part of me.
The other piece of it that I find really interesting is it sounds sort of like the classic, like headquarters versus the field, disconnect between things that work, like theory and practice, right? And you see that a lot. Do you see this in the civilian world between like the boardroom and like a retail front or something, where something really made sense on the chalkboard, but when human beings are involved, it doesn't work?
Yeah, and there's some organizations that do it great, where they'll see something wrong. And I love working with those organizations, because now I'm not working for organizational arrogance solutions. This is more leadership transformation. Okay, wow, these are some positive behaviors. This is great. And then ask those powerful questions. So when they prompt to you that information from the boardroom or from the headquarters, what made you listen? And that junior clerk or that junior representative from that office down in the bottom, what made you listen when they provided this insight? Well, we want everyone to feel comfortable. Wow. So there's some organizations that are doing great by wanting to create an environment of psychological safety where every ideal is great. So it's a learning organization. It's a leading organization. And there's some that people are tiptoeing. And so it does get to a point where there's insight that may come from headquarters, and say, no, we know better because we're headquarters. Yes, but how are we going to groom that next level to be able to make the independent thought and feel encouraged that they're empowered, they're delegated to make these decisions that are not catastrophic to the organization, but it may still be a learning opportunity. So you find it for both ways. So that's what's exciting about our job, is that being able to identify those organizations that are in danger of getting to a culturally entrenched organization environment, organization arrogant environment, and those who are doing great work say, I don't want that environment. I've seen the tea leaves. I've seen what happened to the Googles. I've seen what's happened to the Sears and the Enrons. How do we avoid that? Okay, how do I make sure that leader trait that I've seen that may not look right, how do I stop that? And so being able to have that more preventative measures, the great part. It's, you know, the sad part is when you're in triage mode, okay, how bad is it? Okay, what are you willing to give up? Because you have a section of great, talented people. They're on their way out.
So I'm curious, like, who brings you into an organization like this? Is this coming from like a board of directors? Is it coming from a CEO? Is it coming from like a human resources department? Because basically you're going to come in and tell them you're doing something wrong, right? So who brings you in? And then how is that, like, on a human level received by the people that you're now coming in to criticize or change what the way they're behaving?
Well, not all about solving the problem. Sometimes, again, we do this regular leadership development, corporate workshops, retreats of that nature. But if there is something where perhaps a new leader came in, again, leadership or culture. And so, but sometimes the culture will remain, a new leader comes in. I've had organizations where I was the lead. I'm like, okay, wow, what happened here? Trust already against me is gone because they may have been through a rash of leaders prior to that were toxic, irresponsible. And so now before you start trying to implement your vision, your mission, they're like, I don't trust you. So now how do you build trust now to say, okay, let's get the quick wins. Give me an opportunity to fail you. But understand, and I apologize, the leaders before me have failed you. Now this is what I plan to do and hold me accountable. And again, it goes back to authenticity and transparency. And so when I have organizations may say, hey, Dr. Vic, we heard you last week. We really want to spend some time with you. And they could be in the situation, hey, we're doing things great. We'd love for you to evaluate and to see if there's opportunities for, do we have any signs of organizational arrogance? Or, hey, we believe we're doing well in the leadership realm. Can you look at our leadership program? And so that sign, that could come from HR, will come from employee relations, it could come from the CEO. And then there are some that I've had the second in command could be the vice president say, hey, listen, we got a serious issue over here. Okay, what's going on? And now I know I'm coming into maybe military say a hostile territory. I'm coming in hot. Okay, now leveraging some of that expertise from the military. Okay, I know we have opposing forces here, and then I have allied friendly forces. So who's the opposing forces? Well, that person over there has a lot of power and influence. That person does as well, but they don't get along. So now you're dealing with these types of things. So how I come in, again, using a military analogy, I may come in hot because it's a hot zone until I find out where the balance of power is and who really wants us there. Because you're right. If you're the outside consultant coming in and say, all right, I don't want to come in. I'm fixing things. No, I'm here. I come in peace. I understand there are some challenges. And so first thing I like to do is, again, have the conversation with the lead of the organization. What is your goal here? So I know how my team can come in. The other is now doing focus groups. Okay, is this an issue that they see? Is this an issue that middle management see? Or this is an issue that bottom? Then we'll be able to compare those notes. Oh, this is rampant. So that also allows us to know, are we receiving peace? Or they think we're coming to transition and you all need to know that's not the way I ever want to be received. I want us to come in as a way that we have an identified end state, what looks positive, so that we're all working together. It's not that Dr. Vic's coming in and this is how you're going to do it and I'm leaving. No, we're working this together because you own the culture. You own the behavior of this organization. When I leave, I'm off to doing others and we have our coaches come in, but you have to live in this new culture and you have to have that accountability because now you shared with the team, I want this, we want to move this way. And so that is something very powerful when we do understand the motivation of the person bringing us in, because that'll dictate how, I'm not coming in heavy handed. That's because now again, we go back to compliance, not commitment. I don't want compliance. You're just doing it because I told you to do it, but you're not buying into it. So looking at where that commitment is.
Do you encounter hesitancy with a CEO, but a second in command or somebody who's in charge of a department who wants to implement the ideas that you're sharing with them? But if they change radically the way they're doing things and it doesn't work for whatever reason, right? It could have nothing to do with the idea. The idea could be solid. But do you feel like there's a fear in the lower level manager position that if I change things and it doesn't go well, even though it should, I'll be held responsible?
Well, people don't fear change if you're sudden change. And so being able to usher in a change plan, being methodical, being able to share along the way, hey, I'll come in peace. But understanding everyone has a different, first identify what's their resistance to change. Okay, what is it that you fear here? And really having those hard conversations. Many times people go into organizations, I'm going to change this. Okay, but do you understand what you're up against? It goes back to, I'm coming in a hot zone. Okay, you guys think that we're broken. I didn't say you're broken. What does broken look like to you? You know, there goes the coaching part. You know, as a coach, it's not about me. It's about you. You all want an end state. What do you want? What does right look like to you? How do you want to measure it? And now it's not me that's going to be held accountable. You're held accountable. You told me these are the metrics. I have an ideal of what can happen. But you have to own this after I leave. And so when I had the hesitancy, really having what we call a brainstorming session with those leaders, okay, what's the most What's the resistance to change? Or do y'all have change apathy? When's the last change? How many changes are on now? So really getting to the heart of it before we even dig deep, because again, like in Intel side, IPB, intelligence preparation in the battlefield, before we get deep in here, what are we up against? What are the threats? What are vulnerabilities? What's that center of gravity? All these things that I can take from my military expertise to here, it's still overlaid with a civilian lens. So I understand, okay, hey team, we're coming in. This is friendly forces. Everybody's excited to see us. Hey team, we got three people who really want us there. Everyone else is not. So expect gnashing of teeth when we go into the HR section or the IT section and say, hey, can I see your books real quick? Expect it. But if we have an advocate and a stakeholder, we know we got some level of top cover.
Yeah, that approach is so smart. But how do you like, when you're talking about success, you're talking about how do you define success as an organization? How do you sort of bridge that gap between bottom line and overall health of an organization? Because they're hidden costs, right? Like the like you mentioned turnover earlier and the cost of, you know, acquiring new people and training them and everything. How do you show when you're doing this kind of consulting, how those sort of intangibles actually really help the bottom line in the long term?
I love going to the HR department. Let me see employee relations, labor relations. I want to see stats, lawsuits, what were the causes, what were the actions, what were reported that never was substantiated, what were the reports that never were followed up on. Now I'm getting an idea. Let me see your employee post results. Let me see the last 5 to 10 years. So I'm doing research now to understand the nature of the organization. Okay, now what's your turnover rate? What's your absenteeism rate? What's your promotion rate? How long are the people who've been promoted? So now I'm getting before I even ask anybody anything, I'm looking at data so I can have the dialogue. And now what's your desired result? Because I now have enough information to have the conversation. Okay, what do you want out of this experience that my team comes over here? Because we will give you an experience, but what do you want out of it? So they'll be able to articulate. So, okay, what are you willing to lose for it? What are you willing to pay for it? Because the organization is going to pay a cost again. And so I can be now with that data. Hey, this is how much your organization is paid for lawsuits. This is how much your organization is paid for new training for people who left. This is the amount of people that left in the average years that a person has departed when they identified the problem, they didn't want to stay in it no more, 15 plus years. So what's your succession planning? So when you lost that individual, now you had to replace them with someone who has less than 8 years. But you lost that because of this. So now that's the data. Now let's have a discussion. What do you want? The desired result, this is what you're getting the way we've been progressing now. Now, if you want to try something different, that can it be any worse than this? And so those help have those kind of difficult conversations. And again, when they're bringing us in, I know there's already at least an inquiry or a level of curiosity. Okay, hey, maybe we're not where we want to be, but maybe we can be better. And Dr. Vigan's team can help us get better, no problem. But let's have the tough conversation. And that's what, even with the book, hey, start the conversation. Let's have the tough conversation, because these situations that we've identified have laid dormant for so long, no one's acting on it. But now when we start showing the organizational cost, the human cost, and if you want the bottom line, I want you to have the bottom line too, but at what cost? And that helps a lot.
So that your organizational arrogance, that term itself, by the way, does that cause any friction when you first come into an organization, that's what you're talking about? So it's sort of a blanket term, right?
Yeah, it is a friction, but no different than someone saying psychological safety or saying the word toxic leadership, saying the word emotional intelligence. That's the word. That's the term, you know, and it's defined. And so now it's, I don't want to have organization arrogance. Great. I don't want you to have it either. So let's have a conversation. Maybe you don't have it, but maybe there's some signs. But we've inherited, and some of us for so long have survived work environments or thrived and said, okay, and that's what makes organization arrogance so powerful. Working on the dissertation, identifying it's not an army thing. It's not a healthcare thing. It's a cross-sectional. And so when everyone can nod their head and say, yes, I've seen that. But you still, again, goes back to academia, still have articles as late as 2026 saying, hey, this is what's happening in the work environment. Okay. So now having that being able to have the conversation, say, all right, yes, organization arrogance. I don't want that. I don't want you to have it either. But you may be trending that way. Let's have the conversation. What is your goal? I didn't know those leader behaviors were creating this to my teammates. Yes, and that's okay. And that's what's so important now is educating, empowering, and equipping. You want to believe that most people don't wake up in the morning and say, I want to have an organization arrogant culture. That's what I want. I want everybody to walk away and just feel disgruntled, discouraged, and all that. No, I want to believe that a CEO or a manager wants to have a great, thriving culture that also is performing well and also treating his teammates well.
So how does this develop? Like, do you see a difference in like a startup to when an organization grows to a certain level, or if it's based in different countries? Like, you know, like what are some of the inputs that make it more likely to go down this road?
It's leader behavior. And so it's when leader behavior becomes ignored. And so cross-sectional, and it was the findings were across international. So the challenge is, it goes back to leader behaviors that become accepted, become expected. So some say, okay, that's just who so-and-so is. Okay. All right. So-and-so now at level one is leading their team of IT, and they're just that jerk. Okay, but they're get the job done. Yeah, but they're supervising 5 to 10 people. Yeah, but guess what? They're still producing. So it must not be that bad. It must not be that bad because the results show. Okay, what do you need to see that it's bad? You need all 10 people to say, we're out of here? But no. So now the other 10 people said, well, I want to get promoted. But I know this is how I was treated. Then he got promoted. He's supervising. Maybe that's how I need to behave. So that's the leadership behavior that seems accepted. So I can do that and maybe I'll get rewarded. The other people say, whoa. So now you got other 8 people saying, okay, I have a decision to make. Is that how I'm supposed to act? Now I feel a little conflict because that's not who I am as a person. But I do want to climb the corporate ladder. I do want to become promoted. And so I'll conform or I'll ignore it and just keep my head down. Maybe my results for itself will speak for itself and I still get promoted along the way. And the other third person says, I don't want any more of that. I'm out. And so being able to understand where organization arrogance, the bottom, that the level one is where we want to inject it first. But because so many in the research showing, because it's been ongoing for so long, there's some organizations that have just dealt with it. So they are so far into maybe stage 4 or stage 5 that that's just who we are. And that's a little bit more harder to chew because now we're helping them change a culture that they've identified as dysfunction became normal. Now, dysfunction is, that's just who we are. And so the goal is identifying the name so people understand what it looks like. And now how do we start working along the way to start corrective behavior action? Okay, this is you should still get that result done, but what about this way? When they said that, what made you discount their idea? Well, because they don't know. How do you know they don't know? How about giving an answer, say, where'd you come up with that information? That sounds like great. And so now it's that training piece. So then eventually, when people understand what psychological safety was and they understand what the workforce should look like, same thing, organization arrogance. We know what that is. We know what it looks like. We know what it feels like. Now, how do we avoid that? If we see it happening, we can nip it in the bud. And so that becomes the challenge because we're introducing this term. But we've been operating in it for so long. Now I just added a name to it.
Is there any data that shows, like, for a subordinate working under a bad leadership style, like how likely they are to adopt that style? Or just in your experience, is it like more than 50-50? Is it something that's more likely to happen within that organization?
No, and I think that'd be great areas of further research. Now we're putting it out there in the field of academia. Okay, hey, look, this is the 3 types of opportunity that happens. What makes you stay? What made you leave? And what made you conform? And then that allowed at least from a phenomenological study or just a research aspect, say, okay, why did you stay there for 30 years? Okay, what made you finally that last 19th year say, enough is enough, I'm out of here. And so there's not enough research on that at this time to say, okay, what creates the research question would be, what allowed or what keeps employees in organization arrogant environments and what caused them to leave? And that'd be great data to identify, and that's something that I hope to find as this is my life work. Okay, identifying, okay, now as we go have these conversations and people now feel comfortable having these conversations, what led you to stay?
So there are a lot of different management styles. When you're coming in to fix the problem, are you using a blend of different styles? I mean, you're obviously saying don't do this, right? But how are you, what's prescriptive when you're going in? Is it different at different levels or different types of organizations?
Again, leadership styles, you have a variety of leadership styles from charismatic leader to autocratic. Even the most charismatic leader can be used in the evil. So, you know, I always try to be careful in how we identify each leadership trait, because depending upon the person's intent and motivation, it could go from influence to manipulation. And so really understanding, I do a deep dive of that person, of that organizational leader, so I can understand from a self-awareness standpoint, what's their leader identity? And then what is their goal? And so now being able to understand, okay, I don't need to change you to be, if you're a transformational leader, now I say, well, you need to be charismatic. I wouldn't do that. Who are you? And a lot of times you talk about insecurity, people don't know who they are. And so that, you know, not having that level of self-awareness creates the level of insecurity. And so if I understand who you are, now I can make you, help you be more effective for who works for you, who you work with, and who you work for. But not having that, having that gap right there and understanding what's the motivation when someone says we're going to do it this way. And so being able to be, again, curious in my environment, but open to everyone's leadership style, everyone's leadership journey. Say, okay, now, and then the powerful question, how effective has this been for you? And if they want to be real, we want to have that real honest conversation, let's have the discussion. Okay, that hasn't been as effective. Well, this person is effective with, this person is not. So now we can look from an emotional intelligence standpoint where that gap may be. Is it self-awareness? Is it social awareness? Is it relationship management, self-management? What are those things that may contribute to the challenge that they're experiencing?
Are there any companies now that you feel like are doing it right? Are there examples? Are there things to look for to say this is a good pathway?
Well, what I like is when I see organizations that are investing in their people. You know, I know I'm a relationship-oriented leader, so I'm not going anywhere and say, are you a relationship-oriented leader? That's the only best way to do it. No, you're a task-oriented leader. That's okay. But how are you utilizing that? And so what I've found is that organizations who are truly sewing into the people, allowing them to have, they can have what they call brown bag lunches, or they're having concerted time. But the most important is that they're listening, that they're listening. It's one thing to say, hey, we have this program. Then I go to the organization one time and say, yeah, well, we have great employee engagement programs, and we have all these great, okay, great. What day is that? Tuesday at 12:30, right there in the food court. Great. I go down there at 12:30 on Tuesday. No one's there. Okay, it breathes well, and I see all the flyers around. Oh, yeah, but on Mondays at 10 o'clock in the morning, we do this. That's what it says on the flyer. When I went down there, no one was there. And when I went and had a focus group, they said no one goes because no one cares. And so the organizations that are not only saying it, and in my fraternity, we have a poem which said, live your creed. It says, I'd rather see a sermon than hear one any day. So great, I hear all this stuff, but what's happening at ground truth? When I ask someone in IT department or the HR department, can they validate what we are doing? And so that's where I'm always trying to do the fact check. And so there's organizations that are living their creed, having programs, and then being able to watch the employees grow and understand their development programs, sit in their staff meetings and watch how dialogue and how people are challenged openly without feeling the sign of disrespect, and being able to come to collaboration. Disagreement doesn't equal disrespect. How you disagree may equal disrespect. And so when I see those types of organizations, I understand, okay, they're doing it right. Hey, there's some areas that you may be, that may be a challenge in the future, and there's some things you're doing well. And being able to come in peace where they say, okay, wow, you're here not only to tell us that we're wrong. No, it's not my job to tell you wrong. You asked me here for a reason. Let me understand what it is. So then when I come in peace and provide a feedback, it's received well. And now together we can work on the plan that you want versus this is Vic's plan. No, it's not Vic's plan. It's y'all plan. You asked some Vic and LTY to come here and show you a way how we can get to this end state together.
That's fantastic. Okay, so we're going to transition in just a minute so you can interact with the crowd here.
All right.
But just for people who are watching us before we wrap up the podcast, where should they go to find your book?
BookDrVic.com is my main website. You also find us on Barnes & Noble and Amazon. And I'd love to see you all on, we also have a Start the Conversation on Book Dr. Vic, where it's an active reading program. So I have created a community. Again, I like to say it's beyond the book. The book was just the start of the conversation. That's just me talking. It's a very interactive book. It's a very challenging book in the sense that we're having a conversation. And though every week on my social media channels, we have an opportunity to engage with me on social media and then also post some of their findings and questions on our Start the Conversation part.
What are those social media channels for people who are listening or watching?
So on my website, bookdrvic.com, I'm on Instagram, Real Dr. Vic, on YouTube, Real Dr. Vic, as well as on X and TikTok, Real Dr. Vic.
Fantastic. This has been really wonderful. Thank you so much. I really appreciate
it. Thank you, Jeff. Well done.